is 91.7 WVXU Cincinnati Edition. I'm Marianne Zalesnik. Domestic violence can be physical, sexual, or emotional. One in four women in the United States will be victims of domestic violence in their lifetimes. And at least four women each day are murdered by an abusive partner. We're going to talk today about domestic violence. My guests are Associate Professor of Clinical Law at the University of Cincinnati, College of Law's Domestic Violence and Civil Protection Order Clinic, Kenyatta Mickles, and UC Law Professors and Co-Directors of UC Law's Center for Race, Gender, and Social Justice, Emily Ho and Kristen Kalsom. Good afternoon. Glad to have you here.
Good afternoon. Thank you for having us.
I want to remind you that if you have a question or a comment, you can call us at 513-419-7100 or email us talk@wvxu.org. We're also on Facebook and Twitter. I'd like to start out, we've heard the term domestic violence over the years frequently, and it comes and it goes. You hear it more often. But I'm not sure people have a complete definition of what domestic violence legally, specifically is. And I think we'll start with you, Kenyatta. Tell us what it is.
Well, domestic violence, what it comes down to is power and control. Legally speaking, usually the law focuses more on physical violence and threats of violence. But it could be physical, emotional, mental, sexual assaults, stalking behavior, any of those things amount to domestic violence.
Would you like to add?
Well, I think also it, just to make it clear, I think when we think about domestic violence, typically we tend to think about a husband and a wife. But of course, it can happen between obviously unmarried people, including same-sex couples. So just to, you know, be clear about that, some people use the term intimate partner violence.
There's actually a lot of discussion about what's the appropriate term to use because people don't want to think that somehow saying domestic violence suggests that it should be private or kept private, which has been historically a large problem in this area. Intimate partner abuse is something that I've chosen to use in a class that I teach just because I feel like it's a little bit of a broader term, but there's a lot of debate as to kind of what's the appropriate thing.
You mentioned control, and what does that mean, that the one of the people in the relationship really expects to be able to domineer over the other person?
Yes, and by any means that they can discover. It could be financial control, meaning that they control the finances, won't let the other person, the other party, obtain a job, or interferes with the other person obtaining a job by doing things like cutting off the alarm. So the person wakes up late for work and loses their job. It can be anything that can be used to control. Saying I'm going to take the children away, that's a big one. That scares a lot of women who have children and causes them to stay in the relationship.
Do you find that there are any warning signs? For example, you're just starting to get involved with someone. Are there warning signs you should look out for?
Well, sometimes there might be particular warning signs, but I think one of the myths about domestic violence, intimate partner abuse, is that people get into relationships knowing that that's going to be the situation. And I think some of the media coverage and what's been going on now can kind of be used as an example to maybe exacerbate what really is very much a myth. There's lots of statistics out there that talk about the fact that battering often doesn't start until people are married or in a very stable, ongoing relationship. And pregnancy is oftentimes one of the things that first triggers the battering. And in speaking about control, there's absolutely no greater control for a lot of people than once someone is pregnant, they have a relationship with the person who I tend to think of many times as who becomes the batterer or the battering becomes known. Well, you are going to be in a relationship with that person for the rest of your life if you have a child, even if you're not living with them or that kind of thing. So there's a lot of manipulation in these kinds of relationships. So while sometimes there might be warning signs and sometimes it might be obvious, many, many times there aren't.
Yes, and I would add that I think that, you know, one of the
purposes of this documentary film, Private Violence, which will be screening at the Freedom Center on Friday, is to kind of make the case that, you know, we should think of everyone as a potential first responder. And so to kind of think about what are the signs, what are the indicators that you can look for. But one thing I think, and this goes to Kenyatta's point about control, is social isolation. So I think a lot of times people who are being abused and manipulated and controlled aren't allowed to have contacts with their friends or family members, that becomes really limited. They kind of draw into them, you know, into the family more. And that I think that's a really big sign. And, you know, I think violence, also domestic violence, is in some sense a learned behavior. So I think you can look at family histories of violence and abuse and things like that.
Let's talk. You brought up a couple of different things I'd like to follow up on. I want to start first with the pregnancy issue. You said when someone becomes pregnant, that tends to exacerbate the situation. What about pregnancy causes the domestic violence to begin?
Well, I think one of the things that we always need to keep in mind is that all situations are different, so they're going to be complex in their own ways. So I don't want to generalize in a way that suggests I'm speaking for everyone in that situation. But one of the things, when someone is pregnant, first of all, the level of their ability to leave is completely and totally different. Studies have talked about the fact that oftentimes if someone wants to be in control and kind of be the center of everything, once someone is pregnant, then some of that attention is going to go away. There is a different focus, and that can exacerbate the situations. Certainly, sometimes when you're going to have a family, economic strains, other strains on a relationship might be exacerbated. But if you look in almost every a website or information that's passed around about pregnancy now, which is a really good step, that domestic violence is much more publicized and open, but it'll be kind of one of the facts in even a small little pamphlet that pregnancy is a time when battering can start or be exacerbated.
And you were talking, Emily, about the idea of a situation where a person gets into a situation. I'm sorry, I'm losing my train of thought. You were talking about a situation where a person is in the midst of the domestic violence, and then they pull away from their family and they pull away from their friends. Is this something that friends should look out for, to if they notice this with a family member or a friend, that they should try to get involved to help?
I think so. I mean, I think that, you know, we should all be aware, try to be as aware as possible of potential dangerous situations. And, you know, I think there are many reasons why a friend might pull away. But, you know, usually even if there hasn't been physical abuse in a relationship, usually the relationship is not great for maybe other reasons, and there have been other signs. And so I think it's really important to pay particular attention. You know, if you have a friend who's been in a relationship that, you know, you might think hasn't been so great, and all of a sudden they're kind of pulling back without explanation, you know. And I think, you know, and another thing too is that first responders can also be – one thing I learned in the past year, for example, is that, you know, dentists can be really important first responders, because so many women who are physically abused get hit in the mouth. And that can cause dental problems. And, you know, you would just never think of that, you know, as
I
being,
would not ever
right.
Think of
and,
that,
and, no. But, you know, that was pointed out to us by a domestic violence advocate. And it's, you know, a light bulb suddenly went off in my head, like, right, we should all be kind of reorienting how we think about things to look for these things.
When that does happen, when you may notice a problem and you think something is going on with a friend or a relative, what do you do? What actions do you take? What's the best way to approach it?
I think you just need to make yourself available and open to speak, because what you don't want to happen is that you start speaking negatively about this person who's abusing them, but they love. And so that may make them pull away from you and say that you aren't someone I can come to. But you can also give them information about places they can seek help, like Women Helping Women or the Y. Give them somewhere to live, help them safety plan, give them a key to your apartment so they have somewhere safe to go. There's several things that you can do to help the person, and that person being someone close to you, you probably know this, how this person will react. But most importantly, you want them to feel that they can come to you for help.
And not judge, mm-hmm. you know, right. not be judgmental about their situation, I think.
Because so many survivors of domestic violence, I mean, one of the things that they will say is, you know, nobody asked. And I think that lots of times people don't ask, not because they don't care, but they really don't, they don't want to say the wrong thing, or they're afraid of, you know, reacting in a way that's not appropriate. May I speak a little bit about our conference on the summit on okay. Friday? So one of the things that we're doing in connection with the showing of this documentary, Private Violence, is we are convening a summit of different people in the community from all different kinds of professions. We actually asked several people like Kenyatta, who work with victims of domestic violence every day, who would you like to have sit at the table to address some of the issues around domestic violence specific to Cincinnati? And of course, that's the experts in the area, the people from the Y who do this all the time, Women Helping Women. There's a coalition of domestic violence people who, that's mainly what they do. And they have, they're the ones who are the true experts to the questions, for example, that you're posing today. But judges and magistrates need to be educated in these issues. We learned dentists, nurses, doctors, social workers, and just the community. It would be very helpful if someone in the know who actually had that kind of information could let people know, what do I do if I suspect something might be happening with my friend? So we're convening a group of about 60 invited guests at the law school, and we have an entire day planned with different kinds of activities where people who will run across domestic violence in different ways will actually be in smaller, sometimes larger groups to talk with each other to try to strategize what are the particular issues we face in Cincinnati, what might be good action steps to try to work to better the situation.
You're listening to Cincinnati Edition on 91.7 WVXU as we're talking about domestic violence, and we'll continue our discussion in just a moment. You can call us at 513-419-7100 or email us talk@wvxu.org. You also can find us on Facebook and Twitter. This is Cincinnati Edition. This is Cincinnati Edition on 91.7 WVXU. I'm Marianne Zalesnik. We're talking this afternoon about domestic violence. My guest today, our Associate Professor of Clinical Law at the University of Cincinnati College of Law's Domestic Violence and Civil Protection Order Clinic, Kenyatta Mickles. UC Law Professors, co-directors of UC Law's Center for Race, Gender, and Social Justice, Emily Ho and Kristen Kalsom. You can call us at 513-419-7100 or email us talk@wvxu.org. You also can find us on Facebook and Twitter, and you may have heard our guests talking a little bit about a program coming up this weekend at the Freedom Center. There are links and information to that and to the hotlines you might need if you are a victim or need some help, or if you suspect domestic violence in others. You can find all those numbers and all that information on our website, wvxu.org, and go to the Cincinnati Edition page, and you'll be able to find that information. We've talked about people who are suffering from domestic violence, and maybe if you're a friend or a family member, what to look for, how to point that out, see what you can do to help. Where does it all come from, though? Do you find that domestic violence is shared, family member to family member? If you grew up in a home with domestic violence, you're more likely to commit domestic violence, or is that not the case?
I have read studies that indicate that young boys who watch their fathers abuse their mothers, they're more likely to exhibit that same behavior as an adult. That can be the case. It's not always the case, but that can be the case. And there are studies that actually show that.
Do you find that it's a reoccurring situation in families?
Well, I think families in which there are really exacerbated kind of gender roles is also a type of family where domestic violence might be more likely to occur. So lots of times we'll talk about this as a real societal problem and just generally how violence against women is. It's such a pandemic that people can like almost think it's too big of a problem to address or something, or until big public events happen, like what are happening now. It's just kind of the issue that's huge, but not a lot of people are talking about it. And so I think that sometimes just even our society's gender roles there's old historical, you know, work where you could actually beat your wife with something as long as you didn't use a stick bigger than your thumb. That's where that whole idea came from. And there are vestiges of that in society today.
We've talked about you often think of domestic violence, and as you said, violence against women as a male against a female. But as you mentioned earlier, it can be in same-sex couples as well. And it also can be in some rarer cases, women against men. Is that also true?
Sure. Yeah. I mean, men can certainly be abused by their partners who are women. That's certainly the case. I think there's a well-known statistic that, one in four women are abused by their partners and one in seven men. And so that statistic as you said, it's rarer, I think, for men, but it does occur. But I want to make sure that I make clear that domestic violence is still a very gendered phenomenon. And that it is a way historically for men to have controlled women. So while it happens the other way, I think it's still a very gendered phenomenon. That is, it's mostly, women suffer disproportionately from being victims of domestic violence.
And it's also difficult to know how many men are actually experiencing domestic violence, just like it's really difficult to know how many women are statistically, because most men aren't going to report that they're, a lot of men, I should say, would not report that they were beaten by a female. I think it may be more common in same-sex relationships for them to report, not for the violence to happen, but for them to report. So, as Emily said, that one in seven statistic is pretty widely known in this type of conversation. But I personally don't know if we really would ever get an accurate number.
But it could also be not necessarily physical, but it could mm-hmm. be emotional or
sure.
another form of control as well. Mm-hmm. Our phone number is 513-419-7100. If you have a question or a comment today, we're also on Facebook and Twitter. Dennis is calling from Mainville. Hi, Dennis. What's your question?
I have a question for you about the, women are predominantly abused by men rather than the reverse. The medical field and the police field have moved to prevention. Is there anything that can be done in the broader sense of making abuse and battery neither acceptable nor honorable in an adult to another adult?
Are there any programs in place to help abusers not abuse?
It's such a great question. I think that, a lot of the domestic violence and shelter movement has focused on, well, providing shelter, certainly, and also criminalization, which is certainly, I think, an important part of protecting victims of domestic violence. But I think that, to really take this issue on, we as a society have to commit to providing resources to educate and support people who have experienced violence, that leads to their perpetrating violence, right? So I think there has to be a real societal commitment to that. And I honestly don't know that exists at this time. I think that there are some programs for batterers out there, certainly. It varies from state to state and municipality to municipality. There are funds available, to do that kind of work, but I'm not sure how, if it's enough. I don't think it's enough.
Maybe you know more about this, Kenyatta, but the YWCA has a particular program.
Yes, the amends program.
Yes. Mm-hmm.
And sometimes batterers who are convicted are required to attend this program and show proof that they attended the program. In the civil context, the problem that we have when we request that there's counseling for the batterer is the enforcement of it, because this isn't someone who's looking at jail time. This isn't someone who's going to show up at court or domestic relations and say, hey, I completed this. It kind of might be something that's on there, and it's not enforced. And there's also this idea of if this person wants help, they'll seek help. We're not going to force them to get help. So, but there is a program at the YWCA called the Amends Program. And there's another one too that slips my mind.
Dennis, thanks so much for your call. I wonder, and you talk about the varying programs, is it something, and I hate to use the word cure, maybe treated is a better word, but you know, you've sometimes heard the phrase once an abuser, always an abuser. I mean, is it something somebody can come back from?
It's interesting that you asked that question, Marianne, because Kristen and I were just having this very conversation yesterday.
Yes.
about whether it is treatable, whether, you know, and I think that for, I guess we were saying that for some people, certainly it is, but for a few, maybe it's not. I mean, I haven't looked at the research on that, but. You know, it's a really interesting question.
And I feel like until we really have more of a societal commitment to address this issue, as the caller said, you know, what can we do to send a message? This is just not okay. Because honestly, we don't really send that message as a society unless we're in some kind of a point like we are now. And hopefully there'll be some real change and the conversation will continue. But chances could be that this will blow over and then this huge issue that we have in our society won't get the attention that it needs to get the data that we need to figure out those kind of questions. One of the statistics that shocks me that I wanted to point out, especially in talking about, is there something we can do? I think this is a conversation we need to have with people earlier. One in three girls of high school age in the United States experiences domestic violence.
So this starts early. Or it can start early.
Yeah.
Yes.
Yes.
Yeah. So actually the numbers, the highest, the age group where the highest percent of domestic violence occurs is like 18 to
34, I think.
Something. Yeah. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Yes. But it does start early. And that's kind of also at the age when we need to be educating girls about, you know, what's acceptable, what's not acceptable, because it might not necessarily be that the violence is real physical or extreme, but that can be where you start, you know, not speaking up for yourself in the same way or kind of learning how to be in relationship and to send the strong message that these are what healthy relationships look like, I think is something that really needs a strong commitment.
What role do parents play in that? I would assume parents may be the first responders, really, to see what's going on. What should you be looking for your daughters or your sons, for that matter? And what should you do if you suspect that there is some sort of abuse, even if it's not only physical, but perhaps it is psychological or emotional?
I think one of the things that parents could look for, because with all the technology and social media out there, I think they should be their child's Facebook friend and make sure they have access to that. They should make sure there's not tons of text messages going back and forth. That's a sign of stalking behavior that can lead on to more and controlling behavior. You need to respond to me. You need to respond to me. Things of that nature. Maybe they shouldn't let them date. I don't know. The females in particular and the males, they need to start probably in schools when they're 13 years old, explaining to them, this is how you treat a person. This is inappropriate behavior. So that it doesn't escalate into something more. And one thing you can do, especially in Ohio, there, you can actually get a protection order against a juvenile. This just started, I think, in 2010. But that is an option. You can get a protection order against a juvenile. No contact. Stay a certain feet away things of that nature.
Our phone number is 513-419-7100. Jeannie's calling from downtown. Hi, Jeannie. What's your question?
Hi, my question is about the Ray Rice. I know that she was engaged to him at the time the incident happened. I wanted to know from a psychological standpoint, I mean, I don't know her financial status or where she was at or versus he is, but I mean, if something would have happened like that when you were engaged, what part of your mind would be like, okay, I would stay with him and wind up marrying him? Wouldn't you seem like that would have been a perfect time for her to break it off versus if they had already been married?
I guess this goes back to the question that I was going to get to soon is why do people stay in those situations?
Oh, that's a big question. And it's, there's a lot of response to that. Who wants to start?
Yeah. Well, I'll go the caller's question about the Ray Rice incident. From what I know they've been together for a while. They have a child together.
Right.
Mm-hmm. Sometimes victims don't want to seem like a victim. So they think that they can just move on and handle it. So she doesn't want to feel like she still is a victim. And it may, unfortunately, it might have been the safest thing for her to do mm-hmm. was to stay with him, because victims are the best judge of their safety. And even with the fallout afterwards and the rant that she went on, I think, Instagram, and people say, why would she do that? Why is she sticking by him? She has to live in the house with him. If he would assault her like that in public, just imagine what probably goes on in the home. Mm-hmm.
But I guess the people would ask then, why does she have to stay in that house with him?
Well, you know, one of the most dangerous times for victims of domestic violence yes. is when they try to leave. I mean, that is when, you know, they are killed. I mean, this is a very, very dangerous time. And I think, you know, this isn't a really important question to ask because it's an important for people to hear, to understand that leaving is not easy for many, many reasons. Some of them might be economic. You know, if you've already been isolated from your support, your friends and family, and you have you feel like you have limited places to go, where do you go? And then, you know, the whole point of domestic violence is control and manipulation. And as Kenyatta said, you know, the victims are very good judges of their own situation and how dangerous things are. And it is an incredibly dangerous time, sometimes the most violent time.
Jeannie, does that answer your question?
Yes, it does. Thank you.
Thank you so much for your call. Again, our number is 513-419-7100 if you have a question or a comment. Now, that's really an interesting statement that you said the most dangerous time is when the person tries to leave. So for their own safety, they stay. Mm-hmm. But that seems counterintuitive to people who are not involved in that situation, where you think, my gosh, maybe it's unsafe to leave, but gosh, staying if you're in a domestic violence situation isn't good either. What choice do these women have?
Well, go ahead.
It's interesting to think about, okay, what do we even mean by leaving? I mean, just because you're not in the same house as someone doesn't mean they can't come to work and shoot you, which there's, you know, many examples of that. I mean, if you have a child with someone, that person is going to probably, unless they've abused the child, they're definitely going to be given access to your child. People might be afraid of what might happen to the child when they're not there to protect them. I mean, this idea, one of my favorite articles on domestic violence is over 20 years old, but it's called Exit. And it talks about the incredible problem that it's just the case. Almost so many people, that's the big question. Why doesn't somebody leave? As if leaving is just really an easy thing, whether it's economics, whether it's the fact if you have a child with someone, what does that mean to leave? I think a little known fact is how much homelessness is caused by domestic violence. It's an enormous, I think like 50% of U.S. cities report domestic violence as the number one cause of homelessness.
Mm-hmm. So when That's a person right. leaves, they have nowhere to go?
Yeah.
Right. Right. So just to follow up on that, Kristen, so I have some statistics here. The percentage of homeless women who have reported domestic abuse is 63%. Percentage of homeless women with children reporting domestic abuse, 92%. I mean, those kinds of numbers are pretty compelling. You know, another thing that anecdotally I wanted to recount from the film, from Private Violence, was that Kit Gruelle, who is a domestic violence advocate and also a survivor, one of the subjects of the film, actually said at one point in the film, you know, that she did try to leave her abuser. And eventually she had children with him, and she went back because she said it was better to know when it was coming and where it was coming from than to not. She said that she was living in so much fear when she would leave or try to leave, not knowing when he was going to come at her, that she felt it was a safer situation, particularly for her children, if she just stayed in the home knowing, you know, when she could kind of gauge when he was going to come at her, instead of it coming from out of nowhere.
Right. She also said another thing that was really compelling in the film, which, by the way, is going to be on HBO on the 20th of October. We're doing a sneak preview here in
right.
Cincinnati.
It's on Friday.
This Friday night.
Details
this Friday.
On our website, yes. WVXU.org.
But she also said when she was talking in a group that was part of the documentary about the frustrations people can have with people not leaving. And if they're working, they're, you know, like they might go back 6 or 7 times, which I think is actually the number.
Yes.
That is, it takes 6 or 7 times
to actually leave.
And
in
she
order to really leave
just so calmly. Forever. And it made so much sense when she said it. She said, you know, leaving is a process. And so it's not like that first time the first time you left, you might have gone with your parents and mm-hmm. taken your kids overnight or something, but leaving kind of the center of your life, if any of the rest of us think about, okay, what would it be like to leave the family situation that we have? It's not an easy thing. So she said, you know, it's a process.
Mm-hmm. We're talking today about domestic violence. You can call us at 513-419-7100 or email us talk@wvxu.org. You also can find us on Facebook and Twitter. We'll continue our discussion in just a moment. This is Cincinnati Edition. This is Cincinnati Edition on 91.7 WVXU. I'm Marianne Zalesnik. We're talking today about domestic violence. Joining me, Associate Professor of Clinical Law at the University of Cincinnati College of Law's Domestic Violence and Civil Protection Order Clinic, Kenyatta Mickles, UC Law Professors and Co-Directors of UC Law's Center for Race, Gender, and Social Justice, Emily Ho and Kristen Kalsom. You can join the conversation by calling 513-419-7100. Email us, talk@wvxu.org, or find us on Facebook and Twitter. And I want to talk about a number of things that have come up and also the idea of people that want to leave, how to even begin to go about that. But we're going to take a few calls first. And Teresa is calling from the YWCA. Hi, Teresa.
Hi. Thank you for hosting the show to raise awareness about domestic violence in our community. As you probably know, tomorrow kicks off National Domestic Violence Awareness Month, so we're really excited for UC's conference on Friday. But I wanted to just to bring your attention to some new research that's out, that's been out probably the past 5 years, and that is children exposed to chronic domestic violence experience something called toxic stress. And toxic stress really can impact a child's developing brain. And when kids experience this, they often suffer very poor health outcomes later on. And as we know, boys who witness violence are 1,000 times more likely to grow up and perpetrate it. So I work with the Family Violence Project at the YWCA to really raise awareness around the impact exposure has on children. So there's a lot of new brain science research that's out that if people are interested in it, they can give me a call and I can get them connected to the right people. And also I wanted to say that last year the YWCA served 944 women and kids in one shelter. And I can tell you that leaving is the most difficult time for a woman, and it's also the most dangerous time. And that's exactly the reason why we have protective shelters for survivors and their children.
Teresa, thank you so much for letting us know. We don't have that on our website, so if you want to give me a quick phone number for the YWCA, what can people call?
The YWCA's hotline is 872-9259, and it's a 24-hour number. and we can help survivors with safety planning. We can help survivors with access to services. We can make referrals to the YWCA's treatment program for batterers. It's called AMEND. So really, anyone who has any issue related to domestic violence can call our hotline, and we can provide them services or direct them where to go.
And it's
872-9259.
9259. Thank you so much for the call. We appreciate it.
You're welcome. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
I'm so glad you called in, Teresa. She's one of the leaders in this area in the city, and we were actually talking earlier as far as work that people do. The Y does so much work in this area, so I'm delighted that she called in and gave you some of the information about the really fabulous programming that they do.
Nellie has emailed us. She says she's in a service job and saw a woman come in with bruises on her face. How could she have asked if the woman was okay, or should she not get involved?
Well, there's ways of asking. I mean, it could be giving the person your contact information and saying, you know, you can contact me if you're not okay, or giving them contact information for the Y, or Women Helping Women, or the domestic violence hotline. And that could be, you know, just say, I think she called the domestic violence hotline. That is a difficult situation, because that's one of the biggest problems in society, is nobody wants to get involved, and especially in a person's situation that they don't know. But if she was alone and you felt like she was in a safe place, I think it would be fine to just ask, are you okay? Now, of course, if she's with someone who may have abused her and they're standing right there, that's never okay. But if, say, she went to the bathroom and you just followed her, that might have been a great time to just ask her if she's okay and if there was anything you could do.
Michelle's calling from Indiana. Hi, Michelle. What's your question?
Hi. I had a comment. you were talking about why women stay in these situations. And I read a book. It was about fear and how to use it to help you. And he made a statement in this book that said women stay in these situations because they feel like they have no choice. And that really struck me, and I think that's so true, that, I mean, I've talked to women who have been abused, and they said, what else can I do? Where can I go? I don't have any place. I don't have an education. Or for some reason, they just feel like they don't have any other choice, that they have to stay in that situation. If women were given a choice, if they knew they had some way out, they might take it more often. And Michelle, that was it. That was my comment.
All right, Michelle, thank you so much. We had talked a little bit about that and how women do feel sort of trapped in those situations because of a child or because of just the safety of the situation and what would happen if they do leave. If a woman or a man or anyone who feels they're being abused really gets to a point where they say, this is a serious problem, I need to take action, what sort of things should they be doing to help themselves get out of that situation?
I would say the most important thing, and this is something that I teach my students to counsel our clients on, and things I say to my clients, is they need to safety plan first, because that's a big reason that you end up going back. So you're going to leave and you have a baby. Have the Pampers stored somewhere. Have stored at a friend's house. Have just a few Pampers, a few onesies, or depending on however big the child is. Extra clothes for yourself. Your passport, your important papers. Find a way to get that out before, you know, and not think that just one day you're just going to say, I'm out of here, and pack your things and walk out. Don't tell anyone where you're going if you're able to. And then also seeking help from, like Teresa, at the Y, to help them plan and escape and get shelter, help obtain public benefits if this is someone who hasn't worked in a while and doesn't have a job. So, I mean, those are things that they need to look for. But first and foremost, they need to safety plan, have a plan in place.
I've heard of situations in people that when you have a cell phone, you can be tracked by your cell phone, like they put a tracer on your cell phone. I mean, do women have to give up their cell phones just to make themselves unknown as to where they're located? I mean, does that come up at all?
Maybe I have a lot of clients with prepaid phones. So what they'll do is, maybe if they don't give up, even if they have to give up their phone, they can get like the phone from the store with the card. I don't think those are trackable. I don't know. I don't know much about technology, but I don't think you can track those.
Our number 513-419-7100. Aaron's calling from downtown. Hi, Aaron. What's your question?
Hello. Yes. I just wanted to share a couple thoughts. I have actually in the past 5 years lost a sister to suicide, and she was trapped in a relationship, and I just it was very abusive. He moved her to Phoenix from Columbus, Ohio, and she felt like she didn't have any other way out. And we both were exposed to severe child abuse as children. And I guess my question would be, do you have any, I experienced something with in a family setting myself a couple of years ago as a father, a stepfather, and a husband, and things started surfacing that I didn't know, were in there, and I was trying to get help, but I didn't know where to go, and I didn't know what to do, so we ended up getting divorced.
So I guess your question is, where do you go? And I think some of the suggestions, and we do have some of those on our website, WVXU.org, but the YMCA we had talked about, and are there any other places you want to mention specifically? I guess we have links to most of those places on our website.
Yeah, the YWCA, and Women Helping Women, they do help men also. So,
Jim's calling from Norwood. Hi, Jim. What's your question?
Hi. I heard the statistics earlier regarding 63%, 92%, I think. And I'm wondering what activities or behaviors were included in those percentages. The reason I ask is I think you're talking about a very important subject, but it risks being diminished if included in the definition of violence is an overly broad definition. Like last week, a talk show said that abuse included not only punching someone in the face, but also looking sideways at someone. And the next day, the different talk show on your same station equated, said all rape is included. Rape includes not only typical definition of rape, but also using harsh words or shining a flashlight on someone's bottom.
Okay, let me let them respond here. Clearly, physical violence would be considered domestic violence. We talk about emotional violence and other forms of violence. What is the definition?
I think that in the particular statistics that we have been talking about here, especially the 1 in 4 women, that's actual reported physical violence. The point where we're making the abuse is a larger category. Those are usually not in those kind of statistics that we were talking about there, but we want to make sure that it's clear that there are lots of ways that people can be abused other than physically. But I don't think that they are distorting the statistics that we're talking about today in the way that the caller is concerned about. I think that we want to be sure there's a broader definition of that so that people can also understand what else is unacceptable as opposed to just severe physical violence. In the courts, sometimes that's a real issue, and that one of the issues that comes up in the film, one of the people is just beaten to a point. I think the picture is on the website for some of the flyers. And a true legal issue is that if she doesn't have some kind of internal injuries,
Internal tissue injuries.
There's not enough abuse to prosecute. That it has, does she have it would really help if her spleen had been,
So a black and blue mark doesn't count?
Yeah.
I mean, is that so?
Oh, yeah. And the photos, of the victim here are so awful. And there's a scene in the documentary where the assistant prosecutor is looking at these photos, saying, this is terrible, but is there any evidence of internal tissue damage? And it's as a legal standard.
Right.
And it's just really, it's shocking.
Right.
Jim, thanks so much for your call. We appreciate it. Susan's calling from Mason. Hi, Susan. What's your question?
Well, one of my sisters is in a long-term abusive relationship, and it's been the hardest thing I've ever done is to support her through this. And she knows that I got cash set aside for her. And we try to have open conversations. She lives a long, far away, but we don't dare ask her to come home, and we don't dare go visit because we don't want anything to precipitate a situation. So is there support groups for people in my situation, or do you have advice to offer on how you truly support somebody through this for 5, 10, 15 years?
What do you do if you have a family member and they can't get out?
Do any of the groups at Women Helping Women, I'm looking at Kenyatta because I'm not sure, do they have support groups for
family members?
Yeah.
I'm not sure about that. If there's someone at Women Helping Women that wants to call in and let me know, I can't say for certain. But I think what you're doing right now is great. You're staying supportive, especially for this lengthy period of time, and realizing that if you interfere with the relationship, it can bring more danger to your relative. But, you know, maybe there's a way that you could, if possible, she could go into hiding. If there's a way for her to get away, and of course, like I said, have a safety plan in place, and she goes into hiding somewhere when she's really ready to leave.
Yeah, Teresa mentioned, when Teresa from the YWCA called, she mentioned the family, the precise name is slipping, the Family Support Project, or, you know, and she was talking about it in the context of, children and the impact on children. But, you know, maybe you can look at that on their website to see what kinds of programming they offer. And, you know, I think that if there are not support groups for family members, there certainly should be.
And yeah. I'm hoping that at the summit on Friday, these are very helpful, these callers, and thank you so much for letting us be on in this kind of way, because these are the kind of issues that we want to specifically talk about. What's needed in Cincinnati that we don't have? What could we do to improve things?
Susan, thanks so much for your call, and good luck with your situation. I know that's difficult. Our phone number is 513-419-7100. Libby's calling from Mount Auburn. Hi, Libby. What's your question?
Actually, I have a comment. I work for the Cincinnati Syringe Exchange Project, and a while ago, we had a client who decided she was going to get sober, and when she did that, her partner beat the tar out of her, and so she called me to make a safety plan. And part of that was calling Women Helping Women, and I just wanted to express how amazing you guys are, and that you made her safe, and that she's doing better and didn't go back. And I am incredibly grateful, and I just wanted to say that.
Well, Libby, thanks so much for your call. We certainly appreciate it, and I'm glad the situation's gotten better. Thank you so much. Rachel just tweeted at us and says, many stay in hopes a partner will change, but is that likely to happen at all, or are they just fooling themselves?
I would say they're fooling themselves. I mean, simply put, they're fooling themselves, because that's probably the first thing when you talk about the cycle of abuse. That's the first thing that the abuser says, I'm going to change. I'll get counseling. And then it just starts up again. If they're not really seeking out help and from therapy, or if there's a certain religion that they practice where they could seek help there, Too often I have clients where it's not the first time. So the change usually never comes.
And certainly it's got to be actions, not words. Mm-hmm. I mean, if it's just words, I'm going to change, I feel sorry, there's nothing suggesting. That just suggests it's the beginning of a cycle. Mm-hmm. Whereas if you pay attention to what someone's actually doing, that could be a situation that possibly could turn out differently.
We just have a very short moment left here, but I guess the most important advice you'd give to women in these situations is to make a plan, call somebody, because you can call somebody before you're actually going to do anything, right? To just
Absolutely.
Get some advice.
Yeah.
And we have links to all of that on our website, which is WVXU.org. Thank you all very much for being here today.
Thank you.
And thank you for joining us. We've been talking today about domestic violence. My guests have been Associate Professor of Clinical Law at the University of Cincinnati College of Law's Domestic Violence and Civil Protection Order Clinic, Kenyatta Mickles, and UC Law Professors and Co-Directors of UC Law's Center for Race, Gender, and Social Justice, Emily Ho and Kristen Kalsom. Today's technical director was Rick Andres. We also had help today from Kevin Reynolds. Our engineering staff is Don Danko, Bill Dean, and Mike Makinich. Archives of our program are available on our website, wvxu.org. I'm Marianne Zalesnik.